Welcome to That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose
of all things digital health, global health, and leadership.
My name is Success, a student at Cambridge University.
And I am Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
Join us as we chat with some top professionals in healthcare. Enjoy.
Hey guys, welcome back to That Medic Podcast. Today I'm joined by Mr. Bob Lewis and Mr. Graham Watson, the co-founders of Meditech Trust. They are a charity aimed at improving global health in low-income countries by providing medical equipment and training native doctors in modern surgical techniques. Bob is a businessman with vast experience in medical entrepreneurship, and Graham is a consultant urologist. I actually came across Graham at the British Association of Black Surgeons inaugural conference, where he was a speaker, and I was privileged enough to hear his story. And I figured, you know, why not come back and share it with all of you? And so, yeah, on the 2nd of June, 2021, the Meditech Trust was awarded the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service. And for those of you who don't know, that is the MBE for voluntary groups and is basically the highest honor any individual group can attain. The charity also received a special designation to this award for providing a very impactful support to the community in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. So today's episode is perfect for anybody who's interested in making a real boots on the ground difference in global health. So thank you so much for coming on, and massive congratulations for all that you've done. Bob and Graham, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. As kind of a tradition on the podcast, we like to ask our guests, why medicine? So Graham, to you, why did you go into medicine? Why did you choose it? And to you, Bob, why medical business? Because I had a quick stalk on your LinkedIn, and I see you've worked in a medical kind of entrepreneurship before. So yeah, why medicine?
For me, medicine was because I fell in love with biology. And my father was a cardiac surgeon, so I was absolutely determined that I was not going to be a doctor. But inevitably, I slowly started getting pulled in, and it grabbed me. So I sure as hell wasn't going to become a surgeon. But guess what? The greatest part of medicine is surgery. And so, okay, but at least I won't be a cardiac surgeon.
You got one win there.
One win.
Yeah. No, I completely understand. I won't go into it too much here, but I had a similar thing in that. Not that my dad was a doctor, but there was always this kind of idea that I was going to go into medicine. So up until, you know, my final year in college, I wanted nothing to do with medicine. And, you know, now here I am on a medicine podcast with medicine research papers around me and studying medicine and all this kind of jazz. So, you know, it's funny how life works out. And for you, Bob, medical entrepreneurship, medical business.
Yes, in fact, I have no medical background as such, other than being a patient at various times. Obviously, when I was in business, I was traveling throughout the world. So I was able to witness at first hand the poor conditions that most people lived in compared to ourselves.
Yeah.
And always felt that at some stage I would do something to try to remedy that. And then when the opportunity came with the Millennium to fundraise to support the Millennium and celebrate it, medicine obviously became the reason behind it. And obviously, with Graham being the recipient of that particular week's efforts, and we then developed Meditech Trust, I've had a sharp learning curve over the last 20 years, so, and can now pronounce some of these names that most people cannot.
No, that's all right. Honestly, I still struggle. So no, you're in good company there. Just kind of talking about how Meditech Trust came about. So you said, Bob, you came to Graham. How did that whole thing shake down? Did he take much convincing?
No. Actually, I was chairing a committee in Eastbourne to celebrate the Millennium, and we decided to fundraise £5,000 within a week as seed money to help a surgeon or a hospital. And Graham was particularly keen because he wanted to purchase a laser machine, which, of course, at that stage were not really in the UK. So he was very forward-thinking there. And, in fact, after we'd done this 5,000 and presented it to him, many, many organizations and fraternal organizations, businesses, etc., kept contacting me, offering me pledges and monies. So I felt one couldn't pass this up and decided to form a charity. Mm. And what better, as I wasn't a medical man, what better person to have than Graham? And I invited him to be our chair then, so that we had kudos on the medical front. And within, by the time we got the charity started, it took 18 months of all the rigmarole with the Charity Commission. Within the next 3 years, we managed to put 3 laser machines along the South Coast hospitals.
Wow, fantastic.
And in fact, we've never looked back since.
Yeah. Wow, no, that's fantastic. That's great. It is interesting how it all kind of began, because in med school, so right now we're kind of thinking about which kind of discipline to go into. And the one thing that everybody always says about urology is that they get like the coolest toys first. Everyone brings up lasers specifically, right? About how urology always have the coolest stuff. So apparently there is some truth to that. So for you future medics, future urologists out there, congratulations. Very, very cool. So you've kind of talked about how the Medisec Trust kind of came about.
Could I break in here and just say how we got into the medical, international medical?
Absolutely, absolutely. That was actually going to be one of my next questions. Go for it.
Well, at one of our national meetings, a previous trainee of mine from Sri Lanka said, "Hey, Graham, please come out and teach us how to do this operation called percutaneous nephrolithotomy."
Yep.
That's keyhole surgery for kidney stones.
Yeah.
Sri Lanka is a place where they have an enormous amount of stone disease. And they were doing all of their operations with open cuts. And open surgery is brutal.
Yeah.
Compared to the no incision through a tiny little hole from which you recover very quickly. So I said, "You bet." And we went out to, my wife and I, we went out to Sri Lanka, really enjoyed it. Mm. And I worked with 2 wonderful guys there, one of which was, one was Srinath Chandrasekara, the other was Surendra Silva. And we just did continuous stone surgery for 2 weeks. With a little bit of play in between, you'll be glad to hear. Then I came back about 2 months later just to reinforce the message, and then they were up and running.
Amazing.
It was so successful that what we then did was to say, well, let's start putting on training programs. So we bought UK trainees out to experience what life is like in Sri Lanka, you know, working in a low income country.
Yeah.
And but also to get the most stupendous amount of experience with stone disease. And the benefits to all and sundry were that within a very short while, just a few years, Sri Lanka went from doing 99% of its stone surgery by open surgery to 100% by endoscopic techniques. It was just the most fantastic success story.
Yeah.
But in the middle of all this, with the training courses that we put on, we brought in experts from China and India, and that was an amazing boost to my skills. In the UK, we don't realize it, but we work rather in isolation. And the chance to suddenly be working alongside, very closely working alongside people from other countries, you see different ways of skinning a cat and better ways. So I adjusted my technique. It moved me up enormously in my skills. So to my huge surprise, I was one of the great winners from this. so I went to Bob and said, hey, let's start having a part of our charity being the support of international training. Mm. And we haven't looked back from that stance.
Yeah, no, that is fantastic. And I guess just to provide a little bit more context for the listeners, kidney stones and kidney removal and the procedure that you mentioned, although, you know, it might seem like a relatively small thing, right? Kidney stones, they're tiny. For those of you who've never experienced a kidney stone, and I pray that you never will, you know, they are described as one of the most intense pains that a person can experience. Like this 10 out of 10 pain that some people describe as even worse than childbirth. Like it's horrific. And to have Yes. your choice be between live with this horrendous pain or potentially undergo this open surgery where there is a non-insignificant chance that I die, right? Because of the complications, and the lack of sterility, you know, it's not a place that anybody should be in, especially in this modern age of medicine. And so the introduction of this technique, PCNL, endoscopic removal, of stones is something that is, you know, the effects, like I imagine, can't even be measured, you know, because of the impact it has on so many individual lives. And because of the stat that you gave, right? About how many more surgeries are now being done endoscopically. So it is incredible how just this one idea, this one opportunity that you guys had has had such a massive impact, you know, in the way that an entire country does something, right? That's fantastic. Do you guys ever just kind of sit back and think, wow, like we're pretty good at this stuff. Like, do you never ever have those kind of moments where you kind of take a moment to smell the roses and think, wow, we've actually done something really, really good here?
I mostly just get caught up.
There's so much more to do.
Exactly. that I've just got caught up in this terrific movement of so many centers to go and help. It's such fun doing it. It's so rewarding, to your soul to go and do it.
Absolutely.
And the message to my fellow medics is, for heaven's sakes, get interested in medical missions to low-income countries, because everybody gains by it. The whole world gains by it, but you will gain by it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. And it's definitely something that is on my radar to do, at some point, you know, not just because, like you said, not just because of the impacts it can have on the people, but just the benefit to my skills as well. You know, even if purely from a selfish point of view, it is something that is going to be a massive benefit. And you help people, right? What's there not to like about
it? I also say to encourage people to do so.
Yeah.
That we pay for their flights, for their hotel accommodation and their food.
Wow.
In return for their expertise.
Wow.
And we ask people to give up 7 to 10 days to go on a training mission organized by Graham and others that we have, and they go along, impart their knowledge to the local people, and basically they come back feeling good and without having to spend money themselves.
Wow. Like literally sign me up. Sign me up right now, because that is incredible. That's actually incredible. I genuinely don't think I have, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of getting excited at this whole thing. I'm kind of shouting, but I genuinely don't think I've ever met, you know, such pure, like, altruism, for lack of a better phrase.
Yes.
You guys are truly, like, incredible people. And it might seem like no-brainers to you, but outside of your circle, like that, what you guys are doing is fantastic. And I really, really hope and pray that it is something that continues for a long time. I definitely plan to, you know, get involved with the whole process past this podcast, and I plan to promote it, you know, in the uni and with my friends and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, no, I hope you guys continue for a long, 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 long time.
And can I also elaborate on those that say, oh, I can't really afford the time to go, because
absolutely.
With COVID, we realized that we couldn't do trips. And therefore, we needed to use virtual reality to do training, etc.
Yeah.
And Graham's actively involved on that side. So I'd rather he elaborate on that now, and he can explain what we do.
Absolutely.
We take someone like Charles Graham.
Yes, because what we've now got are ways of having a virtual presence in an operating theatre. And we're slowly getting to the point where it will become possible to support a centre without even visiting it. That'll be a great shame. But at the moment, we go, we train, but then we keep the contact going. And if they've got a case where they're going to need our help, we can be there as a virtual presence. And there are various apps now which can give you a virtual presence in the operating theatre, and you can look at different modalities at the same time. So it's not just a camera looking at looking in one direction. You can add in the ultrasound image, the X-ray image, the video image.
Wow!
And you've got a pretty good overview of everything that's going on, and you can direct left a bit, right a bit.
Wow!
You can really help with the procedure.
Yeah, amazing. That is amazing. And just kind of on this whole topic of training, while I was researching your initiative, one thing I really, began to admire about what you guys do is that it in no way embodies this, the white savior characteristics that projects like this, well-intentioned as they may be, are sometimes guilty of displaying, right? It's not as if you go to these countries, turn up, treat some people, and then go, right? It's not as if you're doing this to be seen as, the good guys, right? You train up the local healthcare team. And, from what you've said, it sounds like you don't even go there sometimes, right, with this virtual training. And you just, your sole kind of motivation is the building up of the medicine in these countries. I think that's extremely admirable. So just kind of talk to me more about this training. What does it involve when you actually are able to go to the countries? What challenges have you kind of encountered in setting up these training programs and maintaining them? What kind of stuff have you experienced?
Well, we will get them to put on a load of cases.
Yeah.
And we've now got the, having this ordeal by fire, nothing will faze us. But I would usually start with some sort of a model of the procedure. So I would, for example, put a stone in the middle of a watermelon, and we put that under a C-arm, X-ray fluoroscopy, and train them to get a needle exactly onto the target in the middle of that watermelon. Sounds so simple, but a great way of modeling it and getting the basic principles of the needle puncture right. Once you've got the needle puncture, you're a good way towards the success. The other problems, the inevitable power cuts. One particular difficulty was in Ethiopia. Whenever we bought the C-arm into theatre, the power went. And it was really that with everything that we were using, it was overloading their local supply.
Yeah.
And we just weren't able to use the X-ray. So we had to just go for it and use ultrasound only.
Ultrasound, yeah.
So we had to learn to do the punctures under ultrasound. So when on future occasions they said, somebody, I went to Zambia and they said, what C-arm? We haven't got any. I was able to say, okay, we'll do it with ultrasound. And it's much more challenging, but something that you can then do. And another moment of challenge. I was in the Gambia, and we'd made our track to the stone, just ready to look in to view the stone, when the light source didn't work. And the nurse piped up that, that hasn't been working for the last 6 months.
Unbelievable.
So, oh my God, we've got to puncture right to the stone. We've got a telescope. We've got something to smash the stone up with. We can't see. So what do you do?
Oh, man.
And the answer was, we borrowed the mobile phone from the anaesthetist.
Yeah.
And we took the light the light lead. And we jammed the one end onto the scope, the other end onto the flash lamp of the flashlight of the mobile phone. And man, I was able to see enough to do the procedure.
Wow. Well, so, I mean, first of all, points for ingenuity. Excellent work. Fantastic. But it is crazy that there's even this need for you to be creative in these situations, right?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. That's kind of an issue that you guys are addressing with Medigiv, right? Bob, could you expand on what Medigiv is? And
yes, basically, Medigiv, we used to, for over a decade, just give away equipment as we felt fit. And then with the pandemic, we felt, well, perhaps we should streamline this. And therefore, we spent a lot of time during the pandemic period when we could do nothing else besides PPE, trying to make a system up whereby people could request what they needed rather than what we sent them. And I was fortunate enough to be able to get the name Medigiv and get it trademarked and patented. And we compiled our own website by using WooCommerce. And in fact, Medigiv is like a shop, except when you go to buy things, you don't have to pay for them.
Mm, yeah.
As a result of Medigiv, we encourage hospitals and manufacturers to donate their unwanted medical equipment or unused consumables to us that we can then process, and then we can honor the requests that we get from recipients overseas. The website is not for general public, and we register every hospital that applies so that we know that the equipment is going to a genuine cause and will not be sold.
Yeah. And I will, I'll put your email, the email that you gave me earlier, Graham, in the notes of this podcast.
Oh, yes.
So that anybody
yes.
who's listened to this
yes.
Can get their hospital involved. I think it's an extremely important thing to do.
Yes, just contact inquiries at meditechtrust.org.
Yeah.
And it will be dealt with immediately. Once we managed to set this up, in our first year, we actually distributed and donated over 62,000 items of medical equipment and consumables. And if the hospitals had to buy those, they would have spent well over £1 million trying
wow.
to do that. We
that
do
is amazing.
Try to encourage in each country local charities to support the hospitals and help with the shipping. But if they can't, then our charity will raise the monies to cover those as well.
Yeah.
So no,
fantastic, yeah.
And yeah. already this year, since in the current year, we've given well over 70,000 items out, and I would expect that we will probably double that by the end of our financial year.
Excellent. No, that's fantastic.
We're grateful to the hospitals that kindly donate to us. Without them, it wouldn't be so successful, and we would encourage more hospitals to do so.
Mm.
We take all the liability ourselves, so they don't have to worry about anything such as that. And this way, they know that the equipment is not going to be sold, it's going to a good cause, and it's going to help those hospitals less fortunate themselves.
Fantastic. I guess in a country like the UK, it's almost, you know, a foregone conclusion that you're going to have an x-ray or ultrasound machine? Are you going to have appropriate lead for lining these regions, or an MRI scanner? All this kind of stuff that is extremely expensive. But because we're fortunate enough to live in a country like the United Kingdom, it's just there for us when we need it. But for these people in low-income countries, the same can't be said. And Graham, I think you spoke about, I guess, the real world implications of, you know, not having appropriate medical equipment in a different country. You spoke about it at the BABS inaugural conference. If it's not too much for you, would you mind kind of recounting that experience for you and how it kind of shaped your viewpoint about medicine and about medical equipment and the need to kind of help these countries out?
First of all, before I get into my sad story, everybody should read the Lancet Commission into Global Health, into Global Surgery, in which it points out that 30 million people on this planet each year are facing catastrophic financial ruin or death because of surgical provision being unavailable or unaffordable. 30 million people at any one time.
Unbelievable.
It's massive. Mm. And so lack of surgery, for all its reasons, it is a major cause of loss of life, and these are avoidable deaths. The experience that I'm going to share is a horrible one. I was in the Gambia, and I turned up there to help with urology, and I had with me a flexible telescope, not much else, and a little girl of three was brought into the hospital, and she was breathing her last because she'd inhaled a peanut. And and they were talking about trying to fly her to Dakar, where there was appropriate experience and appropriate equipment. In Gambia, there just wasn't.
Yeah.
So I said, look, there was no way she would survive the flight. She was a couple of hours away from death. It could happen at any moment. In real severe respiratory distress. And I said, well, I've got a flexible cystoscope. That can double as a bronchoscope. Have you got a basket? Have you got anything I can grab the peanut with? And the answer was no. So I made something using a bit of thin plastic tubing and some sutures to pull it together to make a sort of trawling net. And we used this to try to, I could see the nut perfectly. I could get my instrument past it. I could not grab it securely enough to dislodge it and pull it out. I'm afraid she died. And all for the lack of just some little bit of equipment. And that has really made me feel so strongly about the need to get equipment to these countries.
Graham, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. I remember kind of sitting in the conference when you told this story and just being, it's incredulous, right? It's unbelievable. A basket. You needed a basket. And this poor three-year-old girl could have grown up and lived, a long and fulfilling and happy life. And here we are in the UK, where probably millions of them are thrown away every year.
Yes.
And all it takes is for us to just send something over. And there are countless kids like this, who will die every single year, who die every single day just for lack of basic medical and surgical equipment. I couldn't believe my ears. And it's something that if you asked anybody, they would be like, well, yeah, I probably do. Like, it makes sense, right? That probably does happen. But it's just not something that we think about on a regular basis because it's just not happening to us. And I don't think that's good enough, right? Just because it's not happening to us or to our loved ones and people around us doesn't mean that it's not happening to somebody equally important somewhere else in the world. And so it was one of the reasons why I also feel very strongly about what it is you guys are doing and why I'm just so impressed by the work of Medigive and the Meditech Trust. I think it's incredible. And a kind of testimony to your, you know, to the impact of your work, almost in parallel, just in reading your website, you guys were able to save the life of a girl called Mariama in Gambia as well, right? Talk to me about that.
Well, she was a girl with extrophy.
Yeah.
And basically, if that doesn't get treated, it inevitably results in a carcinoma of the bladder.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, extrophy is where the bladder is, the child is born. Yeah, exactly. Outside of the body. Yeah.
And sorry, Graham, go on. Basically, what we did was to just get a campaign going so we could get this girl over to Senegal and get her operated on by an expert reconstructionist who was coming from a charity I work closely with called IVU Med from America. They're an international charity, but based in the States.
Yeah.
And she was operated on successfully.
Fantastic,
and,
yeah.
Her extrophy has been closed, her bladder has been reconstructed, and she's now at school and entered into society. It's transformed her life.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I guess it's not an ideal situation in that, you know, ideally Gambia would have the resources to be able to perform that kind of surgery there and then. And you know, the people, her parents would have been, you know, had the funds to be able to pay for all that kind of stuff. And it just, again, it just highlights the importance of the work you guys are doing in these countries, and why it is equally important that each one of us right now listening to this episode, go to our local hospitals, go to the teaching hospitals at which we are registered with, speak to a senior doctor, speak to somebody who has some kind of pull in the hospital and ask them to help sign up for Medigive and the Meditech Trust. And even if that's something you can't do, even like signing up to go on these expeditions, like Bob said, fully paid for, just things like that have a massive, massive, massive impact. And so, yeah, Graham, thank you so much for sharing that story. It can't have been easy for you, but I felt like the message was important for our listeners. Yeah, thank you so much. So I guess moving on to the close of this episode, I wanted to ask you guys just a question about your experiences with Meditech Trust. Right, what kind of lessons have you learned? What kind of skills have you picked up? Is there anything that you feel is important to share? And it could be about anything, whether it's about medicine specifically, or it's about the running of a company like this, or anything. What have you kind of learned in this time, besides the incredible innovation that you seem to show in every situation, Graham? What kind of skills have you guys learned?
Well, I feel that over the last 20 years, we are, in fact, I will quote Graham here, we're fighting above our weight. That's been told to us by very eminent people. We're quite modest. We just carry on doing everything to try to achieve the goal, which is to try to help others. That's what Meditech Trust is about. During that time, we're unpaid trustees. We don't have professional fundraisers. We have to raise our own monies. We use volunteers so that every penny we can get is actually spent on improving the life of others. In fact, we use a little phrase to sum up what Meditech Trust is about. It's changing lives through medical aid and training. And I think that sums up what Graham and I are trying to do. in our small way to help others who are less fortunate than ourselves.
Yeah, that is a powerful message. A very, very powerful message. Thank you so much for sharing. And I guess final kind of question for both of you. What actionable ways are there for students, even at this early stage of training, to get involved in improving global health? What would you say are easy ways to get involved?
If I can kick off, I think first of all, to experience what life is like in other healthcare settings, going on period of time in a low-income country setting is invaluable. But actually getting involved with one of these missions is something else as well. You see the interaction rather than just turning up and following around the doctors there. Mm. I think that it brings it home even more powerfully. The first thing that what I would like to achieve with a medical student or a young doctor coming on these trips is to just get their heart involved. I want them to fall in love with it. Inevitably, there is then a time when life back at home kicks in and it's very difficult. If you've got a young family, you're not going to easily give many weeks of the year to training in Africa. Of course, you can get involved in other ways, but it's when you've retired or when your children have left home, suddenly there's more time. Late on in one's life as a professional surgeon, you've got all that experience to fall back on. So I think the time when you're most useful as the principal trainer is when you're 50 plus. And frankly, when you're in your 30s and 40s, it's so busy. Life is so busy. Mm. That it's very difficult to give that time. Fine. Just give a very little time. Keep that interest going. Just keep ticking over. And then what we can do to help with collecting equipment and encouraging, I mean, how awful if equipment is being thrown away and when it could be sent to a low-income country. I mean, that's a sin, isn't it? Let's Yeah. make sure it doesn't happen and that everything is saved and sent. Try to persuade your trust to collect certain used items which can be easily cleaned. We collect baskets for obvious reasons, stone baskets. But you know, there are all sorts of things. The stent grabbing forceps, which are now single use, guide wires, needles. And we then send these used items and rely on the local hospital to clean them adequately. Now, a bit of extra research would be very useful to look at, how difficult is it to eradicate all HIV organisms from a basket, for example, because some areas have got, you know, if you're operating in an area with 10% of the population having AIDS, that's really important to know. Just being involved from a distance with the telesurgery, the mentoring without actually visiting. We need a lot of players here. One person can't do it. It's too much work. Let's have an army of us who can help mentor just over a computer from your study. Sharing the load and doing this just one day every fortnight would be a huge contribution.
Absolutely. I completely agree. So that for the listeners, just to quickly recap what was just said there. First of all, keep the interest ticking over, involve yourself in the research, keep yourself updated with what's going on in global health. Encourage your local hospital to donate. If you can speak to somebody, please, please do. And for people and listeners who are already doctors, consider getting involved with the telesurgery. Consider getting involved with the outreach in those other countries. Your experience is invaluable. And yeah, thank you so, so much, Bob and Graham, for appearing on the show. It has been, you know, an incredible discussion and an absolute pleasure to have you both on. To our medical student listeners, I do ask that if you're passionate about it, again, just look into global health, how you can help out at whatever stage you're at. All the legislation and details to do with donations are handled by Medigive. And upon collection of the equipment, your hospital is not liable for the equipment anymore. All responsibility lies with Medigive. So there is no issue, no excuse that they can feasibly give about why it is not possible to donate. So please, please, please get involved. I'm in the process of doing just that with Adam Brooks, which is the teaching hospital in Cambridge. And I'm really, really hoping to get it over the line, because if we could, that would be amazing. Bob, Graham, any final comments that you guys want to make?
Just please do all that you've just said, success, because that would gladden my heart.
Amazing. Amazing.
And that is the episode. Thank you guys so, so much for listening. Please remember to subscribe, rate us, and leave a positive review if you enjoyed. Also, head to the description to follow us on all social media so that you never miss an update.